Newsmakers is brought to you by the Illinois American Water Company. I'm Gary Moore on today's program.
The simple fact is 22.5 years equal to murder? Was that fair? Was that just? Was that accountable? If it had been switched and George Floyd had killed Derek Chauvin, what do you think would have happened? Would he have been charged with second-degree murder?
Youth advocate and journalist Sherry Cannon weighs in on the sentencing of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of killing George Floyd. Also,
I would not think that Marv is a racist, as racist in the sense of as we commonly understand, and that I don't think he has no animus towards black people.
Dr. Marwin Spiller weighs in on a comment made by sports commentator Marv Albert. Was it racist, or are we being too sensitive? First, Sherry Cannon on the sentencing of Derek Chauvin, 22 and a half years.
I was relieved. I'm thinking that hopefully this is the beginning of some real justice when it comes to black and brown people being killed by cops that are unarmed. So I was relieved to see that he actually got a substantial sentencing. I was hoping he'd get the maximum.
The prosecution asked for 30 years. The defense, his attorney, asked for probation. The legal experts were saying that the standard in Minnesota was 12 and a half years. And so the judge went 10 years over that. Knowing those numbers, you're okay with what the judge meted out?
I'm okay with what he meted out. Do I think it was all he should have gotten? I think what he did was first-degree murder. When we look at history, historically, we have brown and black people in prison serving the kind of sentencing he got for nonviolent crimes, drug crimes. When we already know when they serve people, compared the crack to powder cocaine, the sentencing they got. So do I think 22.5 years where he will probably serve, I think he has to serve at least 50% of it, was justice when it comes to someone's life being taken? No, I don't think it was justice. I think it was the start of maybe finally seeing people held accountable when they misuse their power, abuse of power.
The judge indicated that he was not meeting out this sentence to cater to public opinion or to make some grand statement, that he was operating within the frameworks of the law and that this was not the time to do that. Do you think there is a time to do that, to address public sentiment and public perception of our legal system?
I guess I would say, are we past time of having a justice system that has not been just? So, yes, there's time, and the time is now. We actually have seen, I mean, we can name them, and, you know, I don't want to go through Breonna and Trayvon and all of the names that have not received justice for their death. So I didn't understand what the judge was saying about he didn't want to go by public sentiment, or because you didn't need to go by public sentiment. You just need to say and look at the evidence that a man was killed right before our eyes. And it was a slow, and it was a painful, and it was a horrifying death that not only affected him, but all those people, all those children, all those bystanders that were there to witness that. Every single one of them that have been interviewed talked about how they still have nightmares over it. And so there was no justice in the killing. So public sentiment be gone. The simple fact is 22.5 years equal to murder? Was that fair? Was that just? Was that accountable? If it had been switched and George Floyd had killed Derek Chauvin, what do you think would have happened? Well, he would have been charged with second-degree murder. He would have been charged with first-degree murder. He would have been looking at life in prison. So I don't get it.
Chauvin did say something in court. He stopped short of apologizing, but did reference Floyd's family. What did you draw from that, if anything?
I thought it was a hollow statement. I don't see any real remorse or, you know, anything. I think he said he felt bad for him. I can't remember exactly what he said. He never apologized for his actions. And I think he definitely didn't want to admit any guilt because he still got federal charges that are pending against him. I think he probably would have been better off not saying anything. And then that little cryptic statement that he made after that about there'd be more coming out later that might give them closure or something to that effect. I just assume him not have said anything.
Reverend L. Sharpton says it's not enough. The Attorney General in Minnesota said something similar. The Floyd family says this is the beginning of closure of those statements. I'm looking at what the family had to say. And I guess if the family is feeling some closure, that makes me feel a little better.
And I think the family realized, because they have seen and have heard families with similar situations not having any kind of results, no kind of accountability, I appreciate where they're at. And even as someone looking from the outside in, as a Black woman, I appreciated the fact that the judge did, you know, mete out 22.5 years. And I don't understand the law, but I know he could have went up to 30 without being challenged. So I still struggle with why not giving the max. And like I said, I just think they looked at Trayvon's mom. They looked at Eric Garner's mom. They looked at Brianna. And they've seen those families not get any kind of accountability. So they have started, or at least in this case, they did get some accountability. Do they get justice? I don't know how you get justice when their loved ones never come back. And one of the brothers said eloquently, he will never be able to be the first dance at his daughter's prom or wedding or any of the things that a 40-year-old man can look forward to with his children. He'll never be a grandfather. They'll never, you know him. His daughter at 5 or 6, at her young age, you know, she was probably the most poignant for me. She said, I miss my daddy. He used to help me brush my teeth. I mean, this is just a child that body was taken away for no good reason. So, closure, I don't think it'll ever be closed for her.
Criminal justice reform is a goal that's out there. And in the year since this has happened, as you know, we've seen a lot change. Some of the changes have been symbolic with Aunt Jemima gone. Some of the changes have been financial with millions of dollars pledged to HBCU. Some of the changes have been legislative and local law as far as police reform policies. Do you think that we are where we need to be? Certainly, we are more conscious as a nation with regard to police and our community. And it would appear that we're headed in the right direction. So what else needs to be done? What would cap this off in terms of us feeling like, okay, now we're there?
And I think the family talked about that as well, Gary. Pass the George Floyd Policing Act. Pass it with qualified immunity gone. Because qualified immunity has been, you know, part of a federal legislation. So it has to be changed at the federal level. And as long as they have qualified immunity, which means there can never be any civil accountability for actions that police officer, or actually any federal governor employee takes, then that's an unfair. They have no, I mean, there's legal ramifications if it's criminal, but if it's civil, you can't even sue them. So until they can be held accountable financially, which is what qualified immunity actually protects them from, and they've not really been held criminally, I think they're going to continue operating with impunity. And we already know that to be true, because since George Floyd was murdered, how many others have been killed by police officers? The same day George Floyd, that Chauvin was found guilty, 10 miles down the road, Dante Wright gets killed by a police officer who said she thought she pulled her gun. So you've got to be able to hold them accountable. And if we can't do it in a criminal court, then we should be able to come after them financially, because that's the only thing that a lot of times people understand is, if this can affect me financially, then maybe I'll make some better choices. Maybe I won't be that cop that will instead of defusing a situation, I'm going to stop it by, you know, showing my power and with my weapon. So, I mean, pass that law, but pass it with some teeth. I think Reverend Sharpton said, you know, there's two kind of sandwiches. I mean, you could have two pieces of bread, but then if you ain't got no meat in it, then it ain't nothing but two pieces of bread. It ain't really a sandwich. So we need some meat in that law.
When we talk about these things, a lot of times we talk about them on the national level, but we know locally we've had some issues over the years. We know Peoria is on the cusp of getting a new police chief, and we have a new mayor. We have a new attitude with regard to police community relations and new members on that commission. What are your hopes for the city with regard to police community relations?
You know, we could only be hopeful that it's going to get better, because right now, and I mean, if we look at the month of probably May and June, we've had a shooting almost every day in our community. And I think we have to look further than just law enforcement. We've got to look at what some of the root issues on why there's so much shooting. I, for one, think that, you know, we can talk locally, but we still got to get back to national, because I think until we get some sensible gun control laws, until we take off all these guns that can shoot 50 rounds, 100 rounds in a minute. I mean, those things, we've got to deal with that. Locally, I think, you know, we've got to deal with the legal guns on the street. I'm hoping this police chief comes in. I hope he comes in with some real strong ideas on how we address the illegal guns on the streets in Peoria. But then I also know that there is a real issue with unemployment within the ages of 16 to probably 30, especially among young black men. I think part of it's education. There's so many layers and pieces to what is causing all of the violence. And, you know, that whole thing with housing, I think the pandemic had some effects with people that were working, losing their jobs. I mean, domestic violence went up. There's just so much that be dealt with. But I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that we're coming with new ideas, with, you know, a cooperative attitude where people really want to, you know, work together and do some things. I'm excited about the commission that was put together between the county and the city with addressing criminal justice reform. I'm excited about Representative Jahan Gordon Booth and the work she's doing at the state level, and some of the dollars that she's bringing in at the local level that's going to be making some changes. I'm excited about new leadership at the Urban League that might be doing some more things with training and education. So I'm very hopeful at the local level, but I do know that policing is only a part of the issue. All those other things have play a big part in why we need to do a lot of work at the local level.
I know you're doing some stuff with Elite. How's that coming with young people?
I'm excited about what Elite's doing right now. We've got a new concept to Elite. It's called the Game Changers. During the pandemic, when young people were not in school and they were getting online, there was a lot of kids that were just getting lost in the system where either parents were working or they didn't have the proper internet at home or they just weren't getting online. We worked with Dr. Carrad and Dr. Ike and Dr. Bell and Derek Booth on Elite becoming a hub that brought in these children that was getting ready to get lost in the whole virtual training area of learning and brought them together under one roof. Every day we had them where we made sure they got caught up on their homework, where they were getting online. We were going to pick them up at home, bringing them to Treewind Pavilion where we were working out of, where we were programming out of. And those kids all got caught up where they were, you know, being absent because where they weren't checking in online. So we was getting attendance corrected. And more than just making sure that they were getting online, we was giving them that social, emotional connection that they needed. They got to go fishing and, you know, just did some, we was teaching them how to play chess. They were reading books. They were, you know, playing checkers together. They were putting puzzles together. So we were doing a lot of life skills with them. And then, now they're home on summer, the school district reached back out to us and said, we've got a group of eighth graders that are not going to get promoted to the ninth grade. These were kids that we didn't have a touch with. So we've got a group of them, about 35, that we're programming with them, just really working with math and reading, and more about life skills, more about the importance of going to school. How do you do anger management? How do you do conflict resolution? Got a team of people working with them every day out of Lincoln Middle School, Monday through Thursday. They're with us all day, preparing them to get promoted to ninth grade. If they don't stay with us and be successful, they'll have to repeat eighth grade. So we're really being very intentional about trying to work with that age group so we don't have to get them on the other end and get them in reentry. So, and we've got judges working with us. We got Joshua Gunn at the chamber wanting to come in and talk with our kids. Derek is just amazing. So, you know, at least doing some stuff that we didn't, we used to work with, you know, the kids in the middle. But now we figured out we got to get those very at-risk kids, those kids they call the red kids. They need us right now because if we don't get them and be able to do some things to change attitudes and choices, and, I mean, and a lot of these kids are just dealing simply with just a form of PTSD. They have been struggling with just trying to manage and navigate in the world that we live in. So Elite's still working. Elite's still passionate about, you know, hope and letting people know that your today doesn't have to dictate your tomorrow. And Carl's on fire. He's back every day programming hands on hands, and he's doing what he loves. And I think we've got a great team. We've got some people that were actually teachers that left teaching to come to be part of Elite. Because they think that they're making a bigger impact.
Sherry Cannon, thank you for your insight.
You're welcome, Gary Moore. You have a great day.
You too.
And keep hope alive, man.
Hey, I will. I will. Can't help but keep hope alive.
That's all we got, man.
Now to my conversation with sociologist Dr. Marwin Spiller. We begin with his reaction to the Chauvin sentencing. What was your reaction? 22 and a half years. Some people thought it should have been the maximum 30. As you know, the prosecution was asking for 30, and the defense was asking for probation.
Well, I mean, I thought 22, short of the max, I thought 22 and a half was sounds sufficient, particularly given the, you know, the pain and suffering that he caused for the family and the country. And certainly I think that it is a message, a wake-up call, and I'm hopeful that it was going to go a long way in terms of police reform, criminal justice reform. And so I think that 22 and a half years is sounds you know, sufficient for the crime.
You think it will send a message to police officers when they're out performing their duties, if they have an inkling of going negative, that they know there are more serious consequences than what had been the case in the past?
Yeah, I think more so for those police unions, and I'm not so certain as to the individual officers when they're in the moment, but I think that it will encourage departments, unions, to be more sort of diligent in communicating to officers the importance of, you know, of being on the right side of those interactions.
Switching gears to another thing that happened kind of under the radar, as I was watching the Bucks and the Nets, I was rooting for the Nets, but Kevin Durant couldn't pull it out. And so there was a collision on the court between Durant and Giannis Antetokounmpo, and they fell to the floor. And the commentator, Marv Albert, who is retiring this year, said there's some valuable property lying on the floor. I was thinking, wow, this is Juneteenth, and he's referring to these basketball players as valuable property. You heard it. What were your thoughts?
Wow, yeah. My thoughts were that, you know, we've made a lot of progress, but we have so much more to go. And it's not only, you know, Juneteenth, but the fact that we look at these players, African-American players, and we can marvel at the amount of money, the size of the contracts they're signing, the lifestyle and the adulation that they receive in the culture. And at the same time, undergirding all that, it still seems these lingering attitudes about race, people, and property. I mean that sort of seemed like a relic of the past, you know, going back to slavery, that sort of reference. And it's unfortunate, you know, that all the progress, all the symbols, I guess, of progress and sort of the comments suggest that we haven't progressed at all, you know, that those attitudes still linger.
I would like to think that he is not a racist and that he probably has black friends and he probably holds in high esteem some of these athletes and some black people. But the fact that he said that taps into something in the recesses of his mind, something that permeated his conscious some years ago, this whole notion of black people as property is something that is embedded in him. It's a part of the American psyche.
Yeah.
And a lot of us have those kinds of negative perceptions planted in our mind. And so he has this big platform. You have to be careful what you say. And that just comes out because it is there. Or, Dr. Spiller, are we being too sensitive?
No, I don't think we're being too sensitive. I think you're right on some levels. Like, I would not think that Marv is a racist, and per se, as as racist in the sense of as we commonly understand, and that I don't think he has no animus towards black people. Like you said, I suspect that there's a lot of, like you said, a respect for the athletes. But at the same time, I think that those attitudes, I mean, it's the culture. It's what we breathe, we live, we absorb it every day. It's America, and it's just where we are. And I think there's and when we think about what we have experienced with the NBA over the last couple of months, you know, with black players being attacked by fans, And so it's just a part of a long line in the sense of what, you know, I don't want to say white America, but certainly the culture think about black people generally. And I think that it's interesting that you have these very high paid athletes and they seem to be targets of this kind of stuff. I mean, those are the ones that have the, seems to have the most respect and receive the most praise from the broader culture, but yet they are the ones in this moment that are experiencing these sort of incidents. And I think what's also interesting about the comments that were made, that was made, that it went totally unnoticed, that it was so normal. Seems like no one, so it didn't catch any headlines. It didn't make the topic on pardon interruption. None of the sports, you know, channels were talking about shows were talking about it. It just came and it went with no reaction, which sort of again the normalization is so much a part of the culture. What was also interesting.
Yeah, I wouldn't say no reaction. There was some, but you had to look for it on social media, and there were some comments here and there. But yeah, Stephen A. didn't talk about it, and it wasn't in the headline news or national news or anything like that. I have talked to some black people, and they said, yeah, I know what he meant to say, and I don't think it was that big of a deal. And so,
yeah, I would say that it wouldn't be a big deal. It wouldn't be a big deal if it was in isolation. But I think when we consider that you know, Russell Westbrook getting popcorn dumped on him, when we consider Trae Young being spat upon, when we consider you know, sort of LeBron James' family being sort of taunted, tormented during the game. I mean, a fan feels so comfortable just to berate his family to his face. When you consider it in the context of that, when there, you know, there are white athletes, white basketball players who don't receive the same treatment. Black fans don't attack white players. To the same degree that, or to the extent, I mean, I'm not going to say it never happens, but we don't know of any black fans sort of attacking white players, even, you know, in the thick of the game, of the competition. We don't see that, and even if we say that it's just the bantering that goes with sports, what's interesting is that it's only the black players that receive it. So. If that comment was made in isolation, but we see that is still the storyline. We know that, you know, even broader, somewhat off topic, but relevant, you know, the lack of black coaches in the NBA and NFL, we still relatively rare, you know, for, you know, a black quarterback. It's still something that makes the news. As if it's new, it's different, and so it's still the same sort of story where you got black athletes on the court, and you got white men in management on the sideline, and if a black individual manages to make it to be a head coach, he has to have a NBA All-Star record to get that job, whereas white players don't seem to have the same sort of criteria to jump. I mean, when you have Michael Jordan back in the early 2000s who had to play for the Wizards team first in order to be in order to have some stake of ownership in the team. I mean, this is Michael Jordan. He has to play first to increase the value of the team first. And so when you look at it, you know, sports, generally speaking, it's hard to take that comment out of ice to say that it's an isolated incident and that we shouldn't take it serious because it's a part of a long line of slights that black athletes have experienced and are experiencing, you know, throughout perhaps the history of the NBA. I mean, so there's still some inequities that exist even as these individuals are making,
millions of dollars. Yeah.
Still the inequities.
And I would add that had it been two white players who collided and fell to the floor, would he have used the same terminology? We don't know. Dr. Marwin Spiller, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Newsmakers is brought to you by the Illinois American Water Company for WPNV. WPNV, we're Peoria's neighborhood voice.